Job chapter 20, and we'll read Zophar's second reply to Job. All right. Then Zophar the Naamathite answered and said, "Therefore my thoughts answer me because of my haste within me. I hear censure that insults me, and out of my understanding a spirit answers me. Do you not know this from of old, since man was placed on earth, that the exulting of the wicked is short, and the joy of the godless but for a moment? Though his height mount up to the heavens, and his head reach to the clouds, he will perish forever like his own dung. Those who have seen him will say, 'Where is he?' He will fly away like a dream and not be found. He will be chased away like a vision of the night. The eye that saw him will see him no more, nor will his place any more behold him. His children will seek the favor of the poor, and his hands will give back his wealth. His bones are full of his youthful vigor, but it will lie down with him in the dust. Though evil is sweet in his mouth, though he hides it under his tongue, though he is loath to let it go and holds it in his mouth, yet his food is turned in his stomach. It is the venom of cobras within him. He swallows down riches and vomits them up again. God casts them out of his belly. He will suck the poison of cobras, and the tongue of a viper will kill him. He will not look upon the rivers, the streams flowing with honey and curds. He will give back the fruit of his toil and will not swallow it down. From the profit of his trading, he will get no enjoyment. For he has crushed and abandoned the poor. He has seized a house that he did not build. Because he knew no contentment in his belly, he will not let anything in which he delights escape him. There was nothing left after he had eaten. Therefore, his prosperity will not endure. In the fullness of his sufficiency, he will be in distress. The hand of everyone in misery will come against him. To fill his belly to the full, God will send his burning anger against him and rain it down into his body. He will flee from an iron weapon. A bronze arrow will strike him through. It is drawn forth and comes out of his body. The glittering point comes out of his gallbladder. Terrors come upon him. Utter destruction is laid up for his treasures. A fire not fanned will devour him. What is left in his tent will be consumed. The heavens will reveal his iniquity, and the earth will rise up against him. The possessions of his house will be carried away, dragged off in the day of God's wrath. This is the wicked man's portion from God, the heritage decreed for him by God." Well, what do you think? Those encouraging words from Zophar? What's he? He's going further now, and he's being very specific, describing what? The wicked person, exactly. And whom does he envision in the camp fitting this whole mold of the wicked person? Job, right? And he's. And what's the main reason why he would consider Job a wicked person? Well, because he suffered, but why? Why is he getting stronger in his argument now? What is prompting him to do that? Yeah. Job's resistance to what they're saying, Job's contempt for what his friends are telling him about how God runs the world. And so, basically, to them, Job is looking worse and worse. And that's why their depictions of him through the portrait of the wicked person are growing more and more extreme. But really, I mean, aren't you just sick of hearing from these guys already? Yes. The good news is we're almost done. We only have the next session to cover a little bit more of what they have to say. But really, it's just ridiculous, all this nonsense about how the wicked is going to be killed by cobras and all this stuff, and how it's impossible for them to enjoy the food that they gorge themselves on, as if they always vomit up their food instead of being able to enjoy it. I mean, there are stories of the Romans and how decadent they were. They would eat for so long and feast for so long that they would throw up and then keep eating, you know? So, yeah, that's wicked, obviously, and it does describe some people. But as Job will point out, it hardly fits as a description of wicked people in general, that they are never able to enjoy the things that they have. He does mention specific reasons why this wicked person is going down. He says, "For he has crushed and abandoned the poor, seized a house he did not build," so he's accusing this person of injustice. And he talks about how there was nothing left after he had eaten, so this person is feasting all the time, and yet leaving nothing for other people, the poor. Okay, so they understood that it was important that when you have provision, that you leave some for those who have none. And Job will answer that as far as how his life lined up with that standard. But for the moment, Zophar is accusing him of that kind of behavior. And assuming that God has carried away his possessions, verse 28, in the day of his wrath. Okay, so Here's his second reply to Job. He begins by explaining himself to Job in verses 1 to 3. Again, he's defending himself, as people often have to do when their views are questioned. It's interesting, he always describes himself as a hasty man, because Proverbs 15:28 says, "The mind of the righteous person thinks before answering, but the mouth of the wicked blurts out evil things." So we've talked about how the friends are accidentally, you could say, or unwittingly helping Satan's attempt at getting Job to curse God. And so they're talking about how hasty they are, and it's true. Proverbs 15:28 does seem to hold true, that they blurt out things that are actually evil instead of thinking before answering. And Job will ask them to really think about, to look at him and really think about a situation before offering any kind of answer. And in reading some of what you guys wrote during the class last week, one of the big lessons that you guys seem to be gaining from it is how to respond to a person who's suffering. And that's something that seems to be sticking with you guys. As over and over again you hear them blurting out things and making it worse for Job, you seem to really be grasping the importance of being careful about what you say. So that's good. He goes on to explain the reason for his anger, that he feels insulted. He claims to speak from a spirit of understanding, but his hastiness doesn't fit with that claim that he's making. And so we can be fairly sure, before he even really launches in verses 4 and following, that Zophar's reply is not going to be effective for Job. Right? He's not off on the right foot. Proverbs 15:1 says, "A gentle answer turns away anger, but a harsh word stirs up wrath." And this is certainly true of kids, you know. You can really get kids upset if you give them a harsh answer. And that's sometimes very hard not to do. It's convicting to see Zophar giving harsh answers, the more stressed out he gets, because as a parent that can happen too. You become harsh when you don't understand why your kids are carrying on the way they are. So a gentle answer turns away anger, and you really need the Spirit to enable you to do that, you know. The fruit of the Spirit is self-control, and harsh answers are an example of lacking in self-control. So we all need that kind of work in our hearts. So Zophar, he needs to understand, right, that rebuking Job, who is suffering, is not going to help. It's just going to stir up more resentment. The first thing he says is basically that the happiness of the wicked is short-lived. So he makes that point very clearly. And then he goes on to say that the misery that quickly comes upon the wicked is another characteristic. You find that in verses 6 to 28. It's all about how quickly the wicked, their enjoyment is turned into judgment, right? It says, though his arrogance reaches the heavens, all of his greatness will be buried in the earth and forgotten like dung. It says, the wicked person will not be able to enjoy dishonest profits. The fruit of his evil profit tastes sweet. He is forced to vomit it up again, and he can't hold on to it. And then emptiness and ruin will be God's judgment upon the wicked person, verses 20 to 28. He's talking, you know, you can see the parallels with Job's fleeting wealth, how everything he has is gone. Though his God was success, he will end up in despair as the true God strips him of his luxuries and he's tormented by this feeling of great loss. So he sees Job in that, a person who's been stripped of everything by God and now he's complaining, you know, when it was all dishonest to begin with. That's what Zophar thinks. Finally, he applies and concludes his description in verse 29. So obviously, he's trying to paint a picture of Job himself if we read between the lines. Summary of what he says then is, I am impatient, and so I'm just going for it here. Wicked people's good times are over in no time. You could describe it that way. He recognizes that they do seem to be enjoying things, but all those good times are over in no time. God repays sin with misery. That's his view. So we've noticed the self-righteousness that the friends are exhibiting. Here's a little story from the 1500s in 16th century England. There was a Christian named John Bradford. He was an English Protestant who was killed for his faith. But he was in prison, I believe, and he was watching a group of, or maybe he wasn't, I actually can't remember that part, but he was watching a group of criminals being led to the scaffold to be hung. And these weren't martyrs, they were people who had actually done, you know, bad things and been convicted of them, and they were going to be killed for it. So he's watching this group of criminals being led to the scaffold to be hung for their crimes, and here's what he said. You probably heard this quote before. He said, "There, but for the grace of God, go I." So there's a very different attitude with John Bradford than there was in the friends, right? They're saying, basically, I'm not suffering like Job is, so therefore I must be okay. And the more they try to explain his suffering by accusing him of sin, the worse and worse Job has to be as a sinner. But I think the same sinful nature that is in the worst criminal is the same sinful nature that's in us, right? Would you agree with that? That flesh is flesh, the sin nature is the sin nature, and everybody has one. And except for the grace of God, you know, my sin nature is just as bad as the worst criminals. So that forces us to look to God and His grace to enable us to overcome our sinful nature. And thank Him we can do that through His Spirit whom He's placed in us. So do you see that in yourself, though, that you look at other people in the news, you know, famous criminals like athletes that cheat by using illegal drugs, you know, in the Olympics or whatever, maybe government officials who steal money that was donated for the poor and basically use it to build their palaces, you know, in other countries. Or, you know, there's all kinds of examples that you can read about. But what's your attitude? Do you condemn that person and think, oh, I'm so much better than that, I would never do that? Or do you tend to think of it like, well, there but for the grace of God, that's what I would be too. Because basically they're just continuing in their desires that come naturally to them. And if I did that, I could end up the exact same way, except for the grace of God. If you feel glad or proud that you would never do such things, you need to read Luke 18:9-14. Does anybody know off the top of their head what story that is? Luke 18:9-14. Yeah, let's read it together. Luke 18. But the important thing is to recognize our own sin nature and be humble about it and look to God to help us overcome it. Verse 9, Luke 18. He also told this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and treated others with contempt. So this is exactly the kind of thing we're dealing with right here in Job. Two men went up into the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee, standing by himself, prayed thus, "God, I thank you that I am not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I get." But the tax collector, standing far off, would not even lift up his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, "God, be merciful to me, a sinner." I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but the one who humbles himself will be exalted. And the message of Romans is, everybody is condemned as sinners, right? And so for all of us, the thing we must do is humble ourselves, acknowledge that, and receive God's cleansing and His salvation, which is a free gift of His grace. So it's an opportunity for an attitude check. The more we read about these guys and all the ridiculous things they say, just let it, you know, keep pressing that lesson onto your heart about your attitude toward other people in relation to sin issues in general, and especially in examples of suffering. Okay, so that's any other comments on chapter 20 with Zophar? That's actually the last we hear from Zophar, believe it or not. So you don't have to listen to that guy again. Are you glad? Yes. All right, but when you do read it, and I hope you do read it many more times in the future, spend more time in the book of Job, just let it remind you of that lesson, you know, for you to check your attitude and your humility before God. There but for the grace of God go I. Shall we do this? I don't know. Cruz is recovering, thankfully, so it's like his tonsil thing went all right.
Well, that's right.
Yeah, no major, no bleeding or...
They remove him? Infection.
Yeah, they remove tonsils and adenoids. So it's been pretty fussy, and having to eat all the sugary stuff has, made it worse. The medicine was kind of rough, but he's pretty much done with everything now.
How old is your oldest?
7. I got a 7-year-old, 5-year-old, a 3-year-old Cruz, who's almost 4, and then a 2-year-old who's almost 3. That's my lineup. We had 4 kids 4 years old and under at one time. So 4 and under. It's pretty wild. Pretty intense.
Yeah, it's really intense.
Yeah. I think that's it, though. We're trying to adopt again, but it's looking less and less likely.
What's preventing?
It's just, no. Not really. I mean, that is a difficulty, but that's not the main thing. The main thing is getting matched up with the kids. Just, like, the agencies have not enough birth mothers replacing because there's other options for them, like mainly abortion. Abortion's easier than ever, especially with, like, the day-after pill and stuff like that. And there are kids in need, but this state is big on abortion, not as big on adoption. And not helpful, and there's, yeah, a lot of the kids that are in need are in other states, and it just, that makes it difficult. The state system can't work with that. That's a lot of the kids that are in need are in the state system. We can't really access that to adopt from there, so. Yeah. And we're not rich and childless, which is makes you less likely to be chosen by a birth mother, so. That's,
interesting. You figured they'd just take anybody with girls.
Yeah, that's the impression that most people have, but it's not really the case, actually. It is. And the state here in our county is big on reunification. So the parents could be in prison for 3 years, and instead of allowing the termination of parental rights and all that stuff to happen, they reunite. No, they would take them out of the family's home that they've been in for 2 years and put them back with mom or dad, who just got out of prison and may go back into drugs and then back and forth and all that stuff. So, yeah. So, I mean, I can understand why a parent's rights, that's a big deal to terminate that, but it's a tough situation for the whole deal. Especially with us who have kids already, and then they'd have like a brother or sister basically for a while, and then...
Well, yeah, just think of what you're doing to the kids.
Yeah. Yeah.
To go with
a complete stranger, who they've never really remembered at all, so... But it's complex, but like we going into it too, we knew that it was complex, and we're just looking to the Lord if he really wants us to, which we already went through a bunch of stuff to get ready, and we are ready. But it's just a matter of him placing the right connection. And I know he can do it if he wants it, but it's just like we're looking out there, and all the typical ways of doing it are like closed doors. So if it happens, it'll just be totally something God just orchestrates, which it would be anyway, but you know what I mean? Like from our humans, there's less and less likelihood from a human standpoint, just being logical about it, which is like not likely, so we will see. But the more time goes on, the more we're like, well, we don't necessarily really think maybe it's not a good idea to get a baby because our next oldest is already 3. That's a big gap to stretch out for our family, and it would be difficult. So, well, that's typically the agency we've been going through, that's typically what happens. So, but yeah, we are open to older kids. It's just not as likely to happen.
So,
what's that? Yeah, and if not, then we'll know. Like, for some reason we were obedient to get ready and to do all that stuff, but that's very true. I'm like scared, but scared of it actually happening. Maybe so. Totally, man. The Lord, and maybe if the Lord just shows us that in the process too, then that's good. To just be fully focused. So. All right, guys, Job chapter 21. Our last chapter for today. All right, then Job answered and said, "Keep listening to my words, and let this be your comfort. Bear with me, and I will speak. And after I have spoken, mock on." You've heard rock on. This is mock on. Or mock on. That's verse 3. All right, enough of the jokes. This is serious. All right, 21, verse 4. As for me, is my complaint against man? Why should I not be impatient? Look at me and be appalled, and lay your hand over your mouth. Lay your hand over your mouth, Bree. Okay. Verse 6. When I remember, I am dismayed, and shuddering seizes my flesh. Why do the wicked live, reach old age, and grow mighty in power? Their offspring are established in their presence, and their descendants before their eyes. Their houses are safe from fear, and no rod of God is upon them. Their bull breeds without fail. Their cow calves and does not miscarry. They send out their little boys like a flock, and their children dance. They sing to the tambourine and the lyre, and rejoice at the sound of the pipe. They spend their days in prosperity, and in peace they go down to Sheol. They say to God, "Depart from us. We do not desire the knowledge of your ways. What is the Almighty that we should serve him? And what profit do we get if we pray to him? Behold, is not their prosperity in their hand? The counsel of the wicked is far from me. How often is it that the lamp of the wicked is put out? Their calamity comes upon them, that God distributes pains in his anger, that they are like straw before the wind, like chaff that the storm carries away." See that he's asking how often that really happens. "You say God stores up their iniquity for their children, but let him pay it out to them that they may know it. Let their own eyes see their destruction, and let them drink of the wrath of the Almighty. For what do they care for their houses after them when the number of their months is cut off? Will any teach God knowledge, seeing that he judges those who are on high? One dies in his full vigor, being wholly at ease and secure, his pails full of milk, and the marrow of his bones moist. Another dies in bitterness of soul, never having tasted of prosperity. They lie down alike in the dust, and the worms cover them. Behold, I know your thoughts and your schemes to wrong me. For you say, 'Where is the house of the prince? Where is the tent in which the wicked live?' Have you not asked those who travel the roads? And do you not accept their testimony, that the evil man is spared in the day of calamity, that he is rescued in the day of wrath? Who declares his way to his face, and who repays him for what he has done? When he is carried to the grave, watch is kept over his tomb. The clods of the valley are sweet to him, and all mankind follows after him. And those who go before him are innumerable. How then will you comfort me with empty nothings? There is nothing left of your answers but falsehood." Good reply, isn't it? He begins with an appeal there, verses 1 to 6, asking his friends to listen with patience, verses 2 to 3. I like this idea that sufferers want an ear and not a mouth. Does that make sense? If you're going to comfort someone, they're needing and wanting an ear, a listening ear, not a condemning mouth. So he defends his own impatience and how he has spoken about his trial in verse 4. He says, "As for me, is my complaint against man? Why should I not be impatient?" Right? Because he's the one suffering. He's not the one just offering quick answers. He's actually suffering. His complaint is against God, not against man. He urges his friends to truly look at his appearance and consider his condition. Again, this has happened before where he says, "Look at me." And it's as if they're going off on their explanations without even really looking him in the face and looking at his condition with the boils and everything else, thinking about it. Does he really deserve this for something he did? You know, and he calls him back to reality and says, "Look at me. Consider my condition," verses 5 to 6. He tells them to put their hands over their mouths, something Job himself does later when God confronts him with the truth. So that basically means shut up, right? It's pretty hard to talk when your hands are right like this. You get the point. Exactly. So the expression means to be quiet. You can see it in Judges 18, 19 and Proverbs 30, 32. But Job's thoughts caused physiological effects. Look at how his psychological state is having this. It says his body trembled when he became aware of his condition once more. When he thinks about, like maybe looks down and actually sees his skin and thinks about it, he starts to shake and tremble. It just like frightens him that much. So he's telling them that rather than just parrot the traditions of who they think are wise men, they should be struck dumb by his actual condition. Like he said in 13:5, "Be silent and let that be your wisdom." Then Job refutes his counselor's arguments in 7 to 26, and it's a great refutation, isn't it? Because here Zophar has been saying about how the wicked immediately are going to be killed by cobras. They're drinking all this, you know, wine and everything like that, but they're just going to vomit it back up again. But Job makes the simple points that the wicked do prosper. Verses 7 to 16. The wicked don't want anything to do with God, yet, you know, they continue on. And he asks, how often does it really happen that they get judged in the way that you're describing? Can you see why his reply is so good and proper? Like, don't you wonder the same thing? Why do you see people who are notorious criminals and who are hurting millions of people, millions of people suffer, and yet the person who's inflicting that, they're fine, right? Yeah. Yeah, I can hear you. Yeah, well, there's a couple of verses that are really key on that issue, and I think you're exactly right. The first is that it's his kindness that leads to repentance. So a person who's blessed in life should say, God the Creator is good, you know, and I should honor him and be thankful to him. But, you know, in reality, a lot of times, you know, they don't. They think, oh, I'm so smart. I, you know, founded this, I'm a self-made millionaire or whatever. People often say that, right, instead of saying, thank God for his abilities that he's given me. So yeah, his kindness can lead people to repentance, and that's what he wants. He also says in Ezekiel that I take no pleasure in the death of the wicked. So to God, he doesn't enjoy the fact that a person dies in that wicked state. So he gives plenty of time. He gave the Canaanites 400 years. He delights in giving plenty of time to give people opportunity, you know, to repent. And he knows exactly how much time each person can have. But I think that's a key verse on it, too, is that God allows them to continue because he wants them to eventually come to a point of acknowledging him, humbling themselves before him, and receiving his salvation. So, but I like the way you point to yourself, you know, when you think about horrible criminals who don't get killed for what they've done. And that points up a good point, right? If God is merciful to wicked people, well, thank God he is merciful because we benefit from that, too, right? I mean, we're all, you know, none of us in this room are too advanced in years, but nevertheless, we had a period of time where we were not right with God, right? Unless, is there anybody in here who's, like, been perfectly at peace with God every moment in their lives? No. Yeah, I mean, thank God he is merciful. Don't you thank God that he doesn't dole out punishment and kill people on the spot as soon as they make an offense and do something wrong? Yeah. So can you see why God is wise to make the world this way, where there's time? Yeah, is there really any other way for him to carry out his plans? Probably not. But here Job talks about how the wicked want nothing to do with God. And there's a little comparison I wanted to show you guys here. Can you kill maybe the rest of the lights over there just so we can see these a little bit more clearly? All right, anybody recognize this? Can anybody name the painting? Michelangelo. Yeah. And the name is The Last Judgment. Okay? So look at this, observe it, and this is an interesting portrayal, right? Because here we have the angels carrying the redeemed up to heavenly bliss, but what's happening at the bottom? Can you make that out over here? Maybe Dewey, can you see? What are those dark figures? They're grabbing people and dragging them. Demons, yeah? Dragging people down into the water below. The abyss, right? Okay, so that's the portrayal there. That's how they picture the last judgment happening, how Michelangelo portrayed it. But here's a different vision of this. Roger van der Weyden. A little bit different take on it. What differences do you notice? In the other one, you had the angels carrying people up to heaven, demons dragging them down to hell. What's happening in this one? Christ is appearing in the middle, right? You got the scales for the final judgment, right? But what do you see happening?
Choice.
Yeah, there's more choice in this one, right? You see the saints looking to him in worship, right? Welcoming him. And what are the wicked doing? They're hiding themselves, like it says in Revelation. Like, they don't want anything to do with it. And they run away from him and therefore into hell. And that's why I think it's good, to, you know, like C.S. Lewis talks about how the door of hell is locked from the inside. What could you do with a person? I mean, what... What future could there be for a person who wants nothing to do with God, the source of all goodness, who doesn't accept what he says and doesn't, you know, and wants to go their own way? What's left for a person but hell? A good way of summarizing is that heaven is where God is, because God is the source of all good. So the closer you are to God, the better things are, right? And so what heaven on earth is, when we get to the end of the Bible, is God's presence being fully on earth and filling the earth with his glory so that he's known by all. And his light fills the whole earth. So where would a person who doesn't want to be with God, where would they be? Describes them as being outside of that New Jerusalem, right? Excluded from it, away from it. And there's no other name for that than hell. Because if you're away from the presence of God, that is the definition of hell. It says that in, I think 2 Thessalonians describes that very well. That, you know, people that are, you know, hell is away from the presence of God, basically. Okay, so the medieval ideas are all about emphasizing, you know, sinners being thrown into hell and burned and tortured and stuff like that. But remember the basics. It's about loving God and wanting to be with him forever. That's heaven, and everything else is hell, basically. So, you know, and it's not that we want to downplay hell or say it doesn't really exist, that it's just, you know, a manner of speaking or just a figure of speech. Hell is real, but, you know, we wanted to be wise in the way we talk to people about it, because it's not very popular today. So explain it properly, you know, and emphasize the good, which is heaven, being with God, and which requires being at peace with him and being forgiven, versus the other option. And you know, show them how serious it is to be reconciled to God. Persuade them of how important it is. Okay, so interesting comparison. You can see how in art sometimes they get things right and they illustrate the lesson the right way, and sometimes they get it not so right. So art can be good, but you have to see whether or not it really matches up with the Bible. Okay, so verse 12 refers to the harp and tambourine. The harp was, it only had a few strings at the time. It wasn't like these massive ones with, you know, tons and tons of strings. But it was just a simple wooden frame with a few strings on it. So that was the harp in those days, but it goes back 4,000 years or more. Then the tambourine was a piece of leather stretched over a hoop, but it didn't have the rattles back in those days. The rattles were a more recent innovation. So, you know, you could still beat it. It would sound more like a djembe, but, you know, just where it's just the drum sound, not the rattling. In case you were wondering what the instruments were like back then, that's how they could be described. So he asks, how often do the wicked actually get punished in verses 17 to 21? He knows what Zophar has said, that basically the children are the ones who inherit all these horrible things because of their parents' wickedness, but he rejects that explanation completely. He says, let them feel it. Let them know the punishment for what they've done, right? What good does it do to punish a person when they're dead? How does that make sense at all? Now, there is the idea where a person's legacy carrying on is a reward for their righteousness, and, you know, the termination of a person's legacy is seen as punishment because their name doesn't live on earth, really. But nevertheless, Job has a good complaint there, right? If you say their punishment is that their children are cut off, well, how does that really serve justice? Does that make sense? Can you see why that doesn't provide a sufficient explanation? And believe it or not, God himself condemns that explanation too. In Ezekiel 18, he says, let this saying, the children, let's see, the fathers have eaten sour grapes, and the children's teeth are set on edge. You understand that saying? It means that the parents do something, but the children feel the effects. He says, let that saying no more be spoken in Israel. The one who sins shall be the one who's punished. A child shall not suffer for their parent's sin, or vice versa. So that's the way God sees it. Now, sometimes people object based on what it says in the Ten Commandments, that God visits the iniquity of the fathers to the third and fourth generation. You know, do you remember that passage? Well, what's going on there is there's a key phrase that says, of those who hate me. So what's happening is that the children do experience judgment, but it's because they continue in the same sin of their parents personally, right? So they actually continue in it themselves. It's not that they're innocent. They love God and that they suffer, you know, God's judgment because of what their parents did. Now, does it sometimes happen that a child does suffer because of the sins of their parents? Yeah, right? But that's not how God judges, right? That's the key. The Bible tells us about God, and it shows us the big picture is that God doesn't judge that way. So, yeah, I mean, most of the people that are hospitalized in mental hospitals in the U.S. today, 9 out of 10 are because the mother got drunk, maybe even just one time while she was pregnant. Fetal alcohol syndrome is the number one reason why people are in mental hospitals for their whole lives. And, you know, that basically amounts to the sin of the parent, right? So, yeah, there's effects of parents to their children, but that's not how God judges. He believes, you know, he says it's personal accountability. So, it's Ezekiel 18, Ezekiel 20 as well. Some key passages on that. All right, and then Job asks, who can challenge God's judgment? Verses 22 to 26. If there was a law or principle higher than God to which he was accountable, so if the principle of retribution governs God, it would actually reduce God to a finite deity, right? And so Job is, you know, really teaching about the freedom of God and how God is the one who's in control. And it's his free choice how he runs the world. Because justice comes from God. It's not a principle higher than God. We've got to remember that when we question God's judgment. All right. And then finally, in verses 27 to 33, he argues that experience proves his counselors wrong. The arguments of Job's friends, if presented as, you know, logical arguments, are actually fallacies. But they, you know, you could also be treating them differently as examples of, you know, just trying to give the best explanation of the situation, which seems to be what they're doing. All right, so let me, let's go into kind of, was there anything else on this chapter that we needed to say? Let's see here. Let me just summarize a couple things. He says, first of all, look at me and listen, observe reality, so to speak. The wicked do prosper. They're not judged in the way that you describe. Their prosperity carries on. It is rare that they suffer. Whether rich or poor, everyone dies. You have wronged me with false answers. Okay? So the advice Job's friends were offering was empty because it did not contain the truth. All the religious fervency in the world cannot give us a reason for hope if it is not a response to the truth. Have you ever heard a sermon where there's a strong emotional appeal, but it's not based on the proper exposition of the passage? All the time? Yeah. Right. So people can manipulate your emotions, you know. People can get other people excited about things. Look at Adolf Hitler. The guy was an amazing speaker. People would have walked away from those meetings thinking, wow, he is awesome, you know. And some people probably even said, wow, he's gifted by God, anointed as a leader of our country. There were plenty of Christians who supported Hitler. And he was an amazing speaker. He got people so worked up that they were willing to go to all kinds of lengths to support his program. But if there's not an adequate factual basis, if it's not actually based on the truth, then we've got real problems. That's why God's revelation in Scripture is so important. Our Christian life must always start with knowing God, which is the goal of life. And when we know God, we then have reasons to love God. And loving God is what gives us the strength to love other people properly. So know God, love God, and then serve God by loving other people. And did you know that, I think we covered it in class, right, where worship is all about the position of bowing before God and then the act of serving God after that, right? So if worship doesn't result in that humbling of yourself before God and then going out to serve God, then something's missing. Now, there is simple like acts of thanksgiving and praise that we can use music to do, of course, but remember that the main thing is going on with worship are acknowledging how great God is, bowing before him, humbling yourself, and depending on him for everything you need, and then going out and serving God as a result. Okay, so let's take a little sidetrack and look at the problem of evil. Now, tell me about the reading in the book. Some of it's pretty heavy, right? Some of the examples that they get into. But sometimes here in comfy Southern California, we need a reminder that suffering is real, right? So I think it's good for that, just to look at different types of things like natural disasters, the loss of a loved one, you know, someone's life ending too early. You know, examples where it seems like surely there could be less suffering in this situation. You know, couldn't God arrange it in such a way that where this person didn't suffer so much? Like, you know, a friend who has cancer, like, why couldn't this, you know, why did they have to struggle for 6 months and then die? You know, why did they have to suffer for all that time and then die? Why couldn't you just take them earlier, Lord, you know? If it's a person who loves God, you just think, why wouldn't God take them earlier and spare them that suffering? But sometimes he doesn't. So let's watch this two-minute video, and we'll watch it twice, actually, because it's really short. But try to pay close attention. The second time through, we'll maybe stop it at a couple points. But just try to jot down any questions you have that come up. Think about what this little video does provide, okay? What kind of an answer it does provide or a summary it does provide, and then also what it doesn't provide. Okay, I'll ask you about that afterward, okay? One, two, three. Actually, yeah, turn off the lights. And if you guys way over here want to go to the back for the next few minutes, it might be helpful. What I'll do is turn up the volume. Down here. Why is this thing so crackly? Do we?
It's probably a bad lapel.
Bad lapel?
Yeah, the lapels are all freaking out right now.
Okay. Well, hopefully it'll work. What's that? My lapels? Like up in here? Are these lapels? What is a lapel? Is it this part? Because if it's these, and I don't wear my mic, my lapel mic on my lapel. Is it this part? I don't know. Will somebody look up lapel on your dictionary you just paid for? Perhaps. Oh, no, it was a calculator.
Yeah, I'll look it up my calculator.
Look it up on your calculator. All right. Okay, here we go.
Is God good? If he is, why is there suffering and evil? Let's assume for the moment that God is all-powerful. This means that God can do anything that is logically possible. So he can create galaxies and subatomic particles and rainforests and you. But God cannot do what is logically impossible. He cannot make a square circle or a one-ended stick. So can God make a rock so big that he can't lift it? No. So what if, when God created human beings, he wanted them to be free? Freedom's a good thing. But if humans are to be free, they cannot be forced to obey God. Because freedom without choice is like a square circle. It's a logical contradiction. No choice, no freedom. God didn't want robots. He wanted real people. The first humans endowed with the awesome power of free choice abused their freedom. The tragic consequences of their bad choice and our bad choices ripple across the world. God is responsible for the fact of freedom, but humans are responsible for their acts of freedom. But let's remember, we don't suffer alone. God will put an end to suffering and evil. And God became a man to suffer with us. God is good, and he wants real people like you to know him. But the free choice is yours.
Pretty good, right? All right, let's do it one more time. And try to, because it took me a couple times watching it, for sure, to really nail down. Try to follow the logic and think about what kinds of things wouldn't be covered by this answer, okay? Ready? Here we go again.
Is God good? If he is, why is there suffering and evil? Let's assume for the moment that God is all-powerful. This means that God can do anything that is logically possible. So he can create galaxies and subatomic particles and rainforests and you. But God cannot do what is logically impossible. He cannot make a square circle or a one-ended stick. So can God make a rock so big that he can't lift it?
Have you guys ever had that question asked you before? Were you ever perplexed about what to do about it? You just need to, you know, the problem with it is it's an illogical question. Yeah, it doesn't require an answer at all. You don't even have to say no because it's an illogical question. Does that make sense? It's like, asking a person, what's the one about, like...
What does the color blue taste like?
Yes, there you go, perfect. What does the color blue taste like? It's an illogical question, and you can't actually answer that yes or no. So, question the question sometimes, right? Sometimes people pose a question that in itself has problems. It has logical problems in the question, so identify that. I'd look for ambiguous terms and try to, you know, really critique the question before you try to answer it one way or the other, and then they, you know, think they've won the argument, okay?
No. So what if, when God created human beings, he wanted them to be free? Freedom's a good thing. But if humans are to be free, they cannot be forced to obey God. Because freedom without choice is like a square circle. It's a logical contradiction. No choice, no freedom. God didn't want robots. He wanted real people. The first humans endowed with the awesome power of free choice abused their freedom. The tragic consequences of their bad choice and our bad choices ripple across the world. God is responsible for the fact of freedom. But humans are responsible for their acts of freedom. But let's remember, we don't suffer alone. God will put an end to suffering and evil. And God became a man to suffer with us. God is good, and he wants real people like you to know him. But the free choice is yours.
It's a pretty quick presentation of the gospel there at the end, isn't it? Very good. The name of it is, I could put the link on the Populi page, yeah. Because I did a screen capture to get that, and I couldn't, is there a way to download YouTube videos and save them, like, as? Okay. I used to have a plugin that did it. Yeah. Well, I know, but I mean to download it.
Like, there's a YouTube downloader.
Is there? Okay. I'd like to get that.
I can show you after class.
Sounds good. Okay, so let's talk about that. What was good about the video? What were some really positive things?
They kept throwing scripture in the background.
Yeah. Yeah, did you pick that up? So it's the one you can watch a million times, you know, if you really want to follow it. Yes. Was that just a stretch? Just a stretch. Okay. No, because God is not even the same category. God, you don't measure God like you measure a rock, right? He's not part of the same material universe in that same way. So it's an illogical question. It's an incoherent question. So, yeah. You can just tell people that's a stupid question. I don't have to answer that. Chase.
I like how the bird got fried in the beginning.
Mm-hmm. What does that bring up? Okay. Does that have anything to do with free choice, though? Okay. Were you saying anything else about that, or?
Because I like how that the four birds from the very beginning.
Uh huh.
One of them got fried.
Yeah.
People like him.
So you got
like
just did.
Oh, it came back in at the end.
Yeah, it's just that one.
Okay.
So I don't know.
Interesting. Okay. So let me ask you this. We had by our house over there every year. We had this tree right by our condo complex thing. And there was a little hole in the trunk. And every year, these beautiful birds with blue wings, parent, mom and dad, would come and lay their eggs there. The birds would grow. They'd come and feed them. And we'd get to hear them chirping every time we walked by. And the kids, we could lift them up and look in the hole and see little bird mouths open and everything like that. Well, one day, we walk out there with the kids, and the tree's cracked and broken down. There's eggs cracked onto the ground below the tree. And there's little, there where the trunk had split, it had opened up and reclosed, and there was sets of little bird legs sticking out because they'd been crushed inside the tree. All right. So the reason for it happening was the termites. Okay. So you see something good and beautiful killed, and the kids are all upset because this was a wonderful thing to see every year, you know, and get to watch, you know, the wonders of God's creation, appreciate it. But then it seems like meaningless evil, right? Meaningless evil, okay? Why did God have to make termites? Well, you start looking at it and think, well, termites help things decompose, which, you know, helps the soil and things like that. So at least, you know, there's something there. But why couldn't he give us this to watch? I mean, every year, keep on doing it, you know? So, but, okay, now what does that event? That is evil. It's right to call it evil, because anything lacking in total goodness is evil, right? Evil is a lack of good that should be there. So what does free choice and God not wanting robots have to do with that? Okay. All right. So here you go. This is where some people do make this connection, connecting natural evil to free choice. God had to create Adam and Eve with free choice, and he made the whole world and the way the world works contingent upon their choice, so that after they chose to sin, that's where we got, like, but here's the question. What would termites do before the fall? Or did they not get created till after the fall? Did they evolve after the fall? You know, or, you know, that kind of stuff.
Well, we were given the charge to tend the garden, and I took care of an orchard for a time, and I had to look out for termites and other diseases that were attacking the tree and possibly jeopardizing its future. So we were given the know-how, and we know how to take care of trees. That one was just, can I say, neglected?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was.
But would there have been those, like, diseases and, like, the termites decomposing stuff before the fall?
Not
just, like, the question.
Yeah, did termites exist before the fall? Did they function differently? Other issues would be like, okay, the problem of animal suffering. You know, why would God make a world in which these animals have to kill other animals, where one has to die for another one to live? The entire animal kingdom is made up of that, basically, right? This is the interesting question. You can see, here's where you're going to have to explain. If someone says, all right, I get the free choice thing, I get that. A world without evil is a world without human beings, because to be human is to have the power of making meaningful decisions. All right, hold on just 1 second. All right, but what about natural evil? Why couldn't God make a better world in which animals didn't have to kill each other and destroy each other, which didn't have termites and mosquitoes and all this stuff? And then if you say it's because Adam and Eve sinned and then all this stuff happened, you're going to have some explaining to do that might be difficult, because you're going to have to explain why did dinosaurs, you know, have those really sharp teeth? Why do snakes have fangs that pump venom into to kill other animals? You know, did that all evolve after the fall or something like that within the last couple thousand years or what? The extent some people go to is to have a children's book on dinosaurs in the Bible, Young Earth Creationist Perspective, and it's to me, a hilarious picture of a Tyrannosaurus Rex eating a watermelon. And it's presented in all seriousness as if in the Garden of Eden, tyrannosaurs were there with their spindly little forearms holding watermelons and using their massive jaws and sharp teeth to eat watermelons, okay? Now, I'm not saying that this is 100% not the right way to go with it, but just realize that you're going to have to explain those kinds of things. Why do snakes have fangs? Did that all get created because of Adam and Eve's choice, or is there some other way of looking at it? Right. The question is, though, where did the predators come from?
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought that when the Lord created everything, he said to man and the animals, I give you the plants for food. And later it wasn't after the flood, he gave man animals for food.
Yeah, I think the quote is just, he puts them in the garden and says, I've given you all these fruit-bearing trees. You can eat of every single one except for the one of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Yeah, well, that's the assumption, is that there was pure vegetarianism beforehand. But even with that, I mean, they are living things still. You know, there's a scale. You go from plants all the way up to animals, basically. You know, so there's still death of plants, at least, in order for some things to live, right? So it's a matter of the level of consciousness, with human beings being all the way up here and then all the way down to, you know, various life forms. So did you have something you were going to? So you'd only eat the fruit that comes off of it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then the rest of it continues to grow? Yeah. So, but did everything eat things like grass, or just the fruit that falls off of things? How do you explain? What did great white sharks eat? Plankton? Okay, there's death. Yeah.
With plants, actually,
spread because it goes through the system and then, you know, from the droppings or whatever. I don't know if every plant was like that. However, it's not actually, it's actually a, in some cases, a tendency for a plant to survive better.
Right. Yeah, the plant death is not typically a major objection to God's existence, but I'm just saying, like, if all death, plant, animal, everything.
You don't eat a human, or you don't eat a cow to make it reproduce more, is my point.
Right.
It's not good for the cow to eat it.
It does, yeah.
The species of cow to eat it.
Right, it doesn't help it continue.
Plants in the natural function to eat sumo.
Yeah, so there's, that's how survival. But, you know, the evolutionary explanation of all that stuff, it, you know what I mean, is there too. That's the way they would look at that whole thing. But, yeah, Tom.
So when Paul says through one man sin into the world, death through sin, is he speaking of death?
I believe it's about human death because it says death spread to all men.
Right. And thus death spread.
That verse doesn't prove that every bit of death came into the world after the fall. Because what kind of tending would be necessary in a picture a garden? What do you do to tend the garden? I don't know. I'm just raising up the issue. So know what you can expect to deal with if you take this video. You know what kinds of things are left out is all we're trying to get into here. Yeah.
Forgive me if I'm missing a point. Verse 30: To every beast of the earth and every bird of the heavens, everything that creeps in the earth, everything that has breath, blood, I've given every green plant for food. Period. And then it says, the Lord looked at everything and saw that it was good. So that's where I'm getting that assumption from. But
yeah.
Personally, what I feel is missing from the video as a second point is this gives us the logical defense, right, to the atheist up in front of 400 people, whereas people are actually suffering. I think the book had a really good point with regard to the material written by C.S. Lewis. When he presented the logical argument, that wasn't as big a seller as the one where it's like, where he expressed his own grief and how he's dealing with it. So, so this doesn't necessarily help the person.
Right, but what this does is show people that a loving, all-powerful God is not incompatible with the existence of evil. And this is the free will defense in the 1970s was presented where at that point atheists were like, here's a logical argument against God. And the free will defense, which was basically what was presented here, shows you that all you have to say is God allows evil and has a good reason for doing so. The logical argument does not succeed once you have that. All you have to do is show that it's not a deductive, like, not, you know what I mean? So that's what is accomplished with that. Yeah.
In the garden, there was no sin before Eve was tempted. That's a known fact. But wouldn't death be considered sin because it's not, in a sense, good? And if God had made another way around death for animals to eat plants, they wouldn't have to eat each other and still sustain life.
Okay, sin is really only something human beings can do. So death and sin aren't the same thing. Death was at least for humans the consequence of sin, right?
Okay.
Where God had made provision so that people didn't have to die, but the sin made death what happened, what passed all men.
Mm-hmm. Say that the right state that Adam and Eve were in before the fall affected all creation, whereas life was fully abundant in every way.
Yeah, there's some things we aren't actually told in the Bible as far as was the Garden of Eden the whole earth, or were they placed in the garden as a special place, a proving ground for what God wanted them to do, right? Because they were prevented from entering back to the garden, it says. So that would indicate that it wasn't a worldwide state necessarily, perhaps so. Yeah.
Sorry, just to point out in Revelation, it says that when the Lord sort of refurbishes the earth for the millennial kingdom, that the lion will eat straw. And eat straw, inferring that right now a lion can't do that. Mm-hmm. Its digestive system isn't set up for it.
Mm-hmm.
What happened, it's been pointed out, like at the fall that the Lord put thorns and things onto plants, that's an adjustment of their DNA.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an argument that it could be possible the Lord adjusted the DNA of many creatures, including making a line so that can't eat meat, and sort of gets it away from the four stomach system.
Yeah, is God able, is the creator of DNA able to alter DNA? Sure. Okay, but here, what I want to lead you to is how you can keep sharing the gospel without getting stuck in the necessity to prove a scientific theory to people, basically. You see where I'm going with this? You know, that's because for me, like, that's what the difficulty was with my brother kind of walking away from the faith, is that I was like, how can I become an authority on science to prove to him in hopes that he comes back to Christianity so that I can get over his scientific objections? Is there a way for me to keep presenting the gospel in a bigger way that kind of covers everything without having to be an expert in science and convince the person that my scientific view and explanation is the one that he should be accepting? You see what I mean? Because it's hard. So I'm not saying that, I mean, I believe everybody should study science and work on fitting it in with the right view of the Bible and everything like that. However, it, you know, you don't want to let it suspend your sharing of the gospel, right? You're deferring this direction? Where? Oh, I'm sorry, I couldn't see you. Yeah, you got to take your priorities. It's just that when people, when they're racking up reasons not to accept the gospel, they'll say, I can't believe in a God who would cause this much suffering in the world in the animal kingdom. And if he's such a great designer, then couldn't he come up with a better design, you know, without this stuff? And so, you know, that's kind of how it connects with, you know. But yeah, you're right. As far as human responsibility, like with even with me in this tree, like if I would have observed, I did have the ability to observe the termites, get rid of them before they killed the tree, basically, you know? I'd have to accept the possibility of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, that's true. That's true, certainly.
Well, the first time you actually see an act of death is when the animals are slain to cover.
That's true.
So it was a direct result of sin that came, that it was sin that resulted in shame that he was covering. And therefore, the first, not all animal death, the first animal death that we see.
That we see. That's recorded in the Bible.
We can speculate all we want on what is not written, but as far as what we know about what's there, the first death was a result of sin. So.
Yeah, okay. Now, what do you say to a person who says, though, as an example, before there were ever humans on the earth, you know, there were animals around killing each other for millions of years. So you see how you need to convince them of, you know, that storyline? You could just say, hey, here's what the Bible says. Accept it, you know, or don't accept it. Or are you getting hung up on a scientific issue instead of saying how the gospel still is bigger than that? Yeah.
Yeah, that's true, because, like, when I went to the mall, I remember I'd be at apologetics last year, and I was just like, oh, yeah, I'm going to go to the mall. I'm just waiting for atheists to come my way because I know the scientific stuff. And, you know, like, the first time I went, I was trying to use, like, you know, knowledge means head knowledge. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and present Jesus, because if Jesus rose from the dead, all the other stuff probably works out, right? And think all the way back, like even if evolution is the true science and the earth is billions of years old, where did it all start? Does that necessarily mean there's no God? And if they're, you know, and if Jesus did rise from the dead, then again, all that other stuff takes the second seat as far as how to work out explaining it and stuff like that. Yeah.
Kind of going with that, like I do believe they have found human remains even if it came in layer, which is the bottomless layer of the fossil mm-hmm. record.
Well, you'd have to convince that
yeah,
that is in fact the case. So,
but
yeah.
Basically, in a DVD called Four Power Questions, he says, you know, it takes faith to believe that all life suddenly appeared, just suddenly appeared at the Cambrian layer.
Mm-hmm.
Layer, and evolutionists struggle with this. It's called the Cambrian explosion.
Yeah.
So for you, it does take a level of faith to believe that everything suddenly evolved. Likewise, it takes faith for me to believe that God was the creator of all of this. However, my faith offers hope
mm-hmm.
in times of grief, whereas in evolution, it's
yeah.
a necessity.
Yeah.
Suffering and death is a necessity.
Right, and then the values that gives you is simply survival. So if I need to kill you in order for me to survive, that's evolutionary values, and you know who are you going to say about it? So let me lay out a basic approach to working through some things with people without, you know, basically where you can get around having to be a complete expert on proving the science, right? And it, excuse me, it amounts to. This is a a little illustration of the problem of evil from a really good book called Hard Questions, Real Answers. There's two great chapters on the problem of evil in here that are excellent. This kind of shows you how the problem of evil needs to be dealt with in different ways sometimes. Like you've got the intellectual problem and then the emotional problem. Different things, different ways of addressing with people, right? Can you see the difference? Intellectual problem is like, you know, where apologetics would come in, where like this video would be helpful. The emotional problem is like, God took my dad away when I was 8 years old. And, you know, I can't forgive God for that, basically. And that's real. Now, you can try to use apologetic arguments with that person, but the real issue, they need to know the love of God, right? More than anything else, personally, the comfort of the living God. Okay, then under the intellectual problem, it splits off into an internal problem, like trying to figure out how we can consistently hold our beliefs, versus the external problem, which says the God of the Bible is extremely unlikely because of the amount of pointless evil that goes on in the world. No, you know, the Christian God could not be real because of all this pointless evil that happens every day that apparently, you know, he doesn't do anything about. Then you have the logical version and the probabilistic version. And so those are just some different ways. And you can attack each area and work on it, but they are distinguishable aspects. Okay, so I want you to remember these key words for if you have an opportunity to talk to someone and they bring up issues about the problem of evil and how it's their reason for not believing in God, okay? Best explanation. Best explanation. There are different ways of doing apologetics, but this one is very simple. Basically, you reason with a person, and you can use every line of evidence that you have. You can use the Bible. You can use what's observable in creation and your own human experience and society, and think about the best explanation. All right? And the person will have a choice. They accept God's explanation in the gospel, and in Jesus, or do they accept the evolutionary explanation, or the Hindu explanation, or the Buddhist explanation, all the other options that are out there, okay? So, basically, this has an appeal, too, because it's a lot like the scientific method, where you make a hypothesis, which is an explanation, right, an initial attempt at an explanation, and then you test that explanation. So, you know, we live in a place where the scientific method is very well known and popular, and people are used to reasoning that way. And so this is simple and works that way as well. So, okay, so let's come up with what would be the gospel hypothesis. What's the gospel? Jesus came to save us from our sins, right? All right, so in that is an explanation of the world. There's a worldview in that. Or you could even lay it out as God created the world, humans fell, God has come to us in Jesus to redeem us, and he's going to come back to make everything right in the end. That's the four-part summary of our worldview. All right, so there's our explanation, and it would involve God created the world and the human fall, God's acts to redeem us, and then the final glorification that we're headed toward. The other explanations would be like, you know, all is one type of stuff. The universe is eternal. We've always all been here. Good and evil are just illusions, and so forth. Or the evolutionary argument is that aliens seeded life on the earth. Maybe, who knows how it happened. But there's an infinite number of universes, and ours just got lucky, basically. All right? So how would you go about testing our explanation versus the other ones? Well, you look at some different things. First of all, you need to test it for logical consistency, right? I've actually got these things on slides here, so let's define hypothesis before we move forward. It's a supposition or a proposed explanation made on the basis of limited evidence as a starting point for further investigation. So we could say, all right, I'm alive, you're alive today. What's the best explanation of our existence? Is it evolution? Is it pantheism? Or is it biblical creationism? All right, then once we have our explanation we're going to test out, we can go about checking it. Put it to the logic test. Is it logically consistent or is it logically contradictory? What would be an example of a logical contradiction which would immediately knock down forever a hypothesis? There's no absolute truth, because that in itself is contradiction, because you're making an absolute claim about reality. So if there's no absolute truth, what you just said to me is not true either, so, you know, it's self-contradictory. Yeah, and there's a lot of things like that you can show the inconsistencies logically with people's explanations. When someone says there's no absolute truth, you can use the logic test to show them that that is not the correct explanation that they can live their life based on. Does that make sense how that works right there? You could use it to test even like the Mormon view of things, because the Book of Mormon says, A, Jesus was born in Bethlehem, and B, Jesus was born in Jerusalem. Logic test, what's wrong with that? It's a contradiction, because it affirms and denies the same thing in the same place at the same time. Both of those statements cannot be true. Are we guilty of a logical contradiction in our worldview when we say that the Trinity is real? Three in one God. No, because we don't say there are three gods, there is one God. That's a contradiction. So we say there is one God, three persons. You see? So it's mysterious still how it works, but that's not a logical contradiction. All right? So that's a logic test. If you find any logical inconsistencies in their explanation of the world, then that's a problem. Yeah. Back to hypothesis. Yeah, it's kind of a long definition, but it's basically just a proposed explanation, and we're looking for, as we explore other people's answers that aren't believers and your answers that you have as a Christian, what's the best explanation? And then that's going to require you to choose how to live your life, basically. And just again, the way this connects to the class is because the problem of evil and suffering, like we see in Job, is the biggest objection people have a lot of times. Got it? Okay, so the logic test is one. The facts test. This is where we look at the facts that we can all observe and think about the best explanation. So our explanation, does it fit the facts of external data? In other words, external things would be not things inside my life experience, but things we can observe, like with the five senses, the things you can taste, touch, feel, smell, and hear. Does what we observe with our five senses confirm or disprove it? If somebody says everything is an illusion, well, you can disprove that pretty quick if you step in front of a bus, right? Because reality is going to hit you pretty hard, and it's not something you want. Reality Bites is the name of that one movie or something, isn't it? I don't remember. I never saw it, but it's a good phrase. But this can also be called the empirical test. Empirical deals with hard evidence, right? It deals with evidence. So you look at the evidence. Does the evidence disprove my explanation? Does it disprove the gospel I'm telling you about Jesus? Now, people could say dead people don't rise from the dead, but look at the evidence, the writings, the gospel accounts, and the early sources for Jesus' resurrection. There's evidence that supports our explanation, even though they say nobody rises from the dead. So the facts test, and the other one is the values test. Compare values. You know, I know intrinsically that it is wrong to kill another person for my own advantage. It's wrong to lie about someone else for my own advantage. But does the evolutionary worldview, does that explanation support my value system that we all have in common? No, right? If survival is the only thing that matters, then why are we so hung up on this morality issue? However, if there is a God, and what's right and wrong is rooted in his nature, then it makes sense that when he commands us to do certain things, that, you know, they are actually real things, and we all know them. So does what we know intuitively, moral, existential, and spiritual data, confirm or disprove it? The atheist worldview, some people say, basically presents you with one question, and it's the question of whether or not to kill yourself. Is life worth living? And some people would respond by just saying, well, life is meaningless, yes, because of, you know, the fact that there's no God. But, you know, we can see some good things going on around us, and we intrinsically know that they're good, so let's just enjoy those things to the fullest and do all the good we can, despite the fact that life is ultimately meaningless and it doesn't matter anyway. All right? Well, that's a contradiction in your values test, right? Because there's not a good reason for you to live that way. You should, the only thing to do would be to live whatever you feel like, right? So those are three areas to test the best explanation by. And when you're talking with a person, you know, you can deal with those things, the world they observe. Like, and the biggest example is we're standing here talking to each other. Where do we come from? What are we doing here, and where is history going? I've got the Christian explanation that we came from God. He wanted to create us, and that, you know, he's redeeming us from sin, and that he's going to, you know, let us spend eternity with him in the future. That's what I can tell you as a Christian, is my explanation. You know, what do you have to offer? And compare and see, you know, which one seems to be the best explanation with the person. Then the values test, you know, just talk with people about the things they value. People value love, right? But is love meaningful if there is no God as the source of that love? You know, only in a finite sense. It doesn't really satisfy. Okay, so does that make sense? Just how to think about, you know, apologetics in that sense of just offering the best explanation. So you can compare with a person and see if maybe they can see at least, you know, some basis for considering the gospel as a more satisfying answer to life. There's plenty of people who have pursued a scientific career and have come to realize that there's questions that science just doesn't answer, but Christianity does. You know, there's deeper things that are addressed with the Christian hypothesis of what God has done in Jesus, the gospel, that, you know, nothing else can really touch on. And so when people see how it satisfies their deepest longings, then there's a real appeal there. So try it out. See if you can talk to somebody and, you know, and just see what their explanation of life is, how they understand themselves in this world, and then offer your vision of life from God's perspective in the Bible. The only homework you